This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, writers, scribblers, lyricists, and scribes of all sorts. I am Brooke Warner, co-host of this right-minded show, along with Grant Faulkner. And Grant, I was thinking today about how we each live busy lives in this big writing world, and we're juggling numerous projects, both on the page and beyond. We both have day jobs that are about writing and circling writing. And then sometimes we just got so much going on that we don't report it out to our right-minded listeners. And so it is time. We did not report out on something really big in your life. And that's that you left your day job that you held in the writing world for 12 long years as executive director of NaNoWriMo. And so, Grant, I want to congratulate you on all of your achievements and also see if you can tell everyone what's next for you and or maybe just even what's happening now.
Thanks, Brooke. And yeah, I'd been thinking about moving on for NaNoWriMo for actually several years just because, as you said, 12 long years. So I just felt like it was time. But also because my side ventures, they're no longer side ventures, really. They've grown into being very central and sizable, and they need more attention. And I'm excited to give them more attention. But it was super hard to transition from an executive director position, especially during the pandemic. You know, a couple of years ago, I worked to promote from within NaNoWriMo and bring an employee up to be co-executive director with me. And I thought I'd transition out after a year or so, but then he found a better job, very fortunately for him. So I said, after that, I just decided I need to put a stake in the ground and give myself a deadline to leave. So I worked it out with NaNoWriMo's board last September that I'd step down after NaNoWriMo 2023 and then work to help the org with that transition, which I finished up in early February. So for the last few months, I've been focused on all of the next, or really it's all of the now, you know. And I just want to pause, though, and give thanks for my time at NaNoWriMo and thanks to the whole community. You know, I don't think I've ever grown as much or learned as much in a job as I did at NaNoWriMo. And it wasn't just a job to me, actually. It was really a life, and a life that will stay with me. But I'm also excited to move on and serve writers in other ways.
Yeah, I definitely hear that. And it's a big deal. You know, 12 years is a lot of years, like I said, and it's also such an amazing place, NaNoWriMo, and you made such an impact, and so many people made an impact on you. So, you know, again, just awesome, and kudos for all that you've done and also for the transition. And you do have a lot of exciting things going on, and I know our listeners want to hear about it. So whatever you can at this point, you know, what are a couple of the things?
Yeah, some things are still to be determined, but I think the most immediate thing is, and I mentioned this a few times in passing, but I've been involved as an executive producer on a TV show, America's Next Great Author. And that's been going on for a few years now. We raised $100,000 and shot a proof of concept in Newark a little over a year ago. And we've been trying to get the show funded and made and distributed since then. And it's been a really interesting, wild journey, kind of similar to publishing a novel, I guess, but with a lot of those almost moments that didn't quite work out, but moments that we also learned from. And right now we're working with a production company, and things are looking really positive that the show is going to move forward. And honestly, Brooke, I think we could do 10 right-minded show on this process, or it could be its own podcast, like making how to make a TV show. I don't know if anyone really knows how to make a TV show, actually. But getting a TV show made is just such a different beast than getting a novel published. But it's been super fun. I love my team, and I'm learning a lot. So no matter what happens, I'm going to be very happy. But beyond the show, I'm working on a couple of other pretty big ventures. I'm working with a couple of partners to build the Flash Fiction Institute, which will be an online hub for classes and resources for all things flash fiction. And I've actually been writing, you know, more tiny stories than I have big novels in the past couple of years. So I'm looking forward to working more with this form of writing. And then I'm teaching a lot. And I have 3 books in the publishing pipeline, including a novel and a nonfiction book about rejection. And I'm writing a memoir of all things now that I've been dabbling in for years. So I plan to do a lot more with memoir in the coming years, in fact.
Well, that makes me very excited. I'm happy you have a lot of irons in the fire. It's super exciting. And, you know, what's interesting to me in all of this is the way that you have stayed in the writing world all of these years. I mean, certainly you've been a writer and an author, but you've been doing a lot of other things that are adjacent to being an author in the writing world. And I've heard you speak about your early years as a writer and how you were somewhat lost in terms of how to develop a career that would allow you to be a writer. You know, and now you've done that for 20 years, but I'm assuming it hasn't quite taken the form you would have imagined.
Definitely not. You know, I got to say, those years, you know, my 20s and 30s, they were full of a lot of angst about how do I do this? How do I earn a living and be a writer? So I consider, you know, this one of the most fortunate things in my life, that I could find a professional home in the activity that gives me the most meaning in life. And the interesting thing for me is that I started out trying to find jobs that supported me personally as a writer. You know, it was all about my writing, but now I find my joy in working to help other people's writing. And I can't tell you how much I've loved teaching writing recently. You know, I feel a sense of gratification that goes beyond anything that I personally write. And then working with you on Right Minded, because even though we don't get paid to do this, we get to talk with all these amazing authors and have this ongoing dialogue about the writing life with each other.
Yeah, I know. I feel so grateful for this and all of the surrounding stuff in my life. You know, to have found work having to do with books is very gratifying. You know, growing up, I didn't even know there was such a career as book publishing. Mm-hmm. I think what happens is kids, of course, and even in college, those behind the scenes jobs just don't get the kind of attention. You know, of course, being an author is so public facing. But then we've lived through the age of the internet. I mean, for me, the internet really came into being when I was just going off to college. And so it's created all of these additional spaces for writers, you know, and people like you and me, you know. So whether it's you doing NaNoWriMo or us teaching online, you know, we've been smack dab in the middle of this explosive growth, which has been so exciting. And it's a constant place of invention and reinvention. So I too feel grateful, Grant. I just want to say, to do writerly work and book adjacent work, and also to be writers and authors. And Grant, you know, one of the reasons that this whole topic fit into today's show is because we are talking about creating new forms, you know, which can be said about writing, of course, but also about the life that we're living and the forms that our lives take. And I know that you especially like today's guest, Elwin Cotman. So I would love to hear how he fits into this theme of creating new forms.
Yeah, you know, I was just so blown away by Elwin Cotman's stories. You know, I discovered him on one of those lists of most anticipated books, which I often think are more about marketing than truly, you know, curated. But his collection of short stories, Weird Black Girls, is just so many things all at once. You know, he's an amazing writer, a true poet, and his writing defies form. You know, I never knew exactly where I stood in his stories as I read them. And his work has this interesting blend of fantasy and reality. And I was just riveted in a way that I often don't find myself riveted. And I found myself inspired by his writing, you know, inspired in that way that it gave me fresh eyes on how to tell a story. And that's interesting for me because I'm getting to be an old guy now. And I remember how when I was a young writer, it seemed like I was being swept away by a new writer I discovered like every other month. But it's been a while for me now. And Elwin is making me, you know, rethink my own storytelling proclivities.
Well, there you go. That's one of the gifts of doing this podcast, isn't it? I mean, we do get to find these gems and to be inspired and re-inspired. And for us, you know, certainly we hope that Right Minded, for all of you listeners, makes you think and rethink the way you tell your stories and rethink your lives as writers. You know, certainly we're all probably trying to make writing fit into our lives in some ways, you know, some of us just as a hobby, some of us as careers. And in preparation for this interview, Grant, I read about Elwin, where he talked about the influences of poetry on his prose. And in his words, he said, Through reading poetry, a writer can become more open to breaking form. You can write an entire novel in a poetic style. You can find new ways to structure sentences, or you can go an entirely experimental direction that explores the boundaries of prose. I love this because I'm in my own, I don't even know what to call it, like a whirlwind of experimentation ever since I read Maggie Smith. And I've been so invested in this on this memoir side of things. So it's just a natural fit for me to be so curious about Elwyn and his work and these natural questions that come, you know, when you're exploring form and what expression is, you know, and it's a lifelong quest for all of us. But I think the more we read, the more permission we find.
Definitely. And Elwyn is one of those writers who just honors his truth in a deep way on the page. And I don't know how to describe it, but he's unflinching. And when I read him, I felt like every word on the page was in service to the story. I got the feeling that it didn't matter where or how the story might be published or any of the business side of writing, but that he was serving the story with a deep honesty, integrity, and invulnerability. And that's what I look for more than anything else from a writer. So I'm definitely looking forward to talking with him more after this short break. Welcome back, everybody. I'm excited to welcome Elwyn Cotman to Right Minded. Elwyn is a storyteller from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He is the author of 3 collections of speculative short stories, the Jack Daniels Sessions EP, Hard Times Blues, and Dance on Saturday. His book, Weird Black Girls, just came out from Scribner, and his debut novel, The Age of Ignorance, will be published by Scribner in 2025. Elwyn's work has also appeared in Grist, Electric Lit, BuzzFeed, the Southwestern Review, and The Offing, among others. He holds a BA from the University of Pittsburgh and an MFA from Mills College, and you can find out more about him on his Substack, which I just subscribed to. Welcome, Elwyn.
Hello.
Well, Elwyn, I loved your collection for a bunch of reasons, and perhaps most of all, I just never knew where a story was going to go. You know, your stories, they don't fit into any box, including length. And I was thinking how rare it is to read a long short story these days, because the conventional short story seems to be getting shorter. And the story Weird Black Girls actually pushed into the borderlands of the novella, which I'll note is, you know, sometimes risky, because the longer a short story goes, the harder it can be to publish it. And I read an interview with you about poetry and prose, and it was such a wonderful interview, both in the ways you talked about fiction writers paying attention to language, but also breaking forms, because poetry invites the breaking of form. So I was wondering if you could speak to your approach to the short stories in this collection in terms of language and poetry and the inventiveness of form, because they're just so wonderfully unique.
Well, I definitely believe in breaking form and trying different forms. The writers who I admire most are ones who sort of play with form. And I think fantasy is, which I'm mainly a fantasy writer, fantasy is right for that, because I think so many just things we encounter in our everyday lives are actually forms of fantasy. You know, I had a story once about a guy who uses magic to make print ads, because obviously in real life, there's not a 50-foot sandwich, you know, that's a form of fantasy. But I think for Weird Black Girls, it was a lot about finding form as I went on. And people tell me, you know, that things I never learned in Caitlin Clark's intro to acting class, that's a circular narrative. I wasn't really thinking about that when I was writing it. Just sort of following the story and seeing where it went logically. But Weird Black Girls, the title story, was definitely something where I very much set out to write a picaresque. And that was the draw for me, was doing a picaresque fantasy story, which is now sort of becoming a bigger genre. You know, people talk about cozy fantasy and that type of thing. But a fantasy where it's not so much driven by the plot as much as it's driven by the characters and where they're going, what they're doing. And so I think a lot about form, especially going into the pieces that I'm writing now. But I think this particular book, it was sort of finding form in the aftermath. And language is something that is always important to me, where if I'm writing, I don't move on from a page until I feel that every single sentence has something. So I'm going back and editing and trying to find a new way to say everything, so that I can grab the reader. And once I'm glossing over and I'm not really paying attention to the language anymore, that's how I know a page is done, right? And then I move on to the next page. So I think, both are very important to me as a writer.
Well, Elwyn, in your acknowledgments, you quote Zora Neale Hurston, who said, "There are years that ask questions and years that answer." And you've said that since your last collection, you've had a lot of questions. And then you list the people who've helped you answer those questions, or maybe who's helped answer those questions for you. I was wondering if you could talk about those questions a little bit, you know, in terms of how they relate to this collection and maybe to writing in general.
Well, I definitely went through a lull in my career. Between my second and third books, it was a period of 7 years, which I never intended to do. You know, growing up, my favorite artist was Prince, who released, you know, 3 albums a year. That was always what I wanted for my career. I always wanted to have something out there. I always wanted to be prolific, and that didn't happen. So the question of, you know, will I get back on track, was definitely on my mind. And, you know, my last book came out during the pandemic, so there wasn't a lot we could do with promotion. So there's that question, you know, what do we do now to, you know, not overcome that fact, because I think Dance on Saturday did really well, but just to keep the ball rolling. And I mean, for me, the questions are always about pushing the language forward, because you can't really tell new stories. It's just the human experience is what it is, but it's the language that keeps evolving. So I had a piece the title piece in Dance on Saturday. I really loved what was going on with the language, because even I wasn't really able to predict where the language was going. And it went in different directions that I'd never really seen in my writing before. So asking myself, can I find a way to push forward with this? And I think I did with the title story, Weird Black Girls, or the Caitlin Clark story specifically. And then, of course, there's other stories where it doesn't really, I pulled back on the language and maybe took a more minimalist approach. So, yeah, I mean, the last couple of years, you know, I had hardships like everybody else. So some questions were answered. Others are still ongoing, I suppose.
Well, Elwyn, I was intrigued because you also singled out Mary Gateskill as an author who deeply inspired you in your acknowledgments. And I was thinking about it. I don't have a single author who I might think of as my source of inspiration, but I do often think of a kind of small family of authors who are essentially voices in my ear, if not more. And I actually took a course with Mary Gateskill once, like a long time ago. Probably it was one of the first classes she ever taught. And so I'm just curious. I was wondering if you could tell us more about how Mary Gateskill inspired you and why you singled her out in your acknowledgments.
I once went to a college where we were looking at sample cover letters to apply for professorships. One of the samples they had, the names were all redacted, but I could tell looking at them, like, this is Mary Gateskill. And I asked the professor, I'm like, Mary Gateskill applied to your school and you rejected her. And that was my signal that I needed to get out of there. But I first read Mary Gateskill in college 20 years ago when I was at Pitt. I was taking a women writers course. And she, because they wanted to, was one of the texts. And I remember just being enraptured. Because they wanted to isn't, I think it's not as famous as Bad Behavior, but there's amazing work that she does just as far as like stepping back from, I want to say that her first book was, you know, more edgy or whatever, but she focuses a lot more on people who would be considered, you know, normal or conservative or square people in society. And what immediately stood out to me is she's so good at finding the contradictions in human behavior, which at that point in my life, I hadn't read a lot of works that actually engaged with that. You know, it's easy to just make your writing straightforward and your characters straightforward and not really engage with those contradictions, but she does, and she does it primarily through language. And that's what grabbed me, not, you know, the sex stuff or the spicy stuff, right? But just precise use of an adjective here, or a verb here, and doing it so that the language itself is contradictory, or, you know, oxymoronic in a way that really captures these feelings people have that, you know, might, you know, like they don't make sense because the human psyche is so complicated. You know, one of my favorite stories of hers that I think, you know, was sort of an inspiration for Weird Black Girls was A Romantic Weekend from her first book, which is about, you know, a masochistic guy and a woman who is, no, the woman's a masochist, the guy's a sadist, but neither of them is particularly good at being either. And the whole story is just these terrible things that happen, you know, when they're together and how dissatisfied they are with each other. But it has a happy ending, you know, as happy an ending as these characters can have. And I'm just like, I don't know how you got here. The fact that there's this happy ending doesn't make me happy. I feel conflicted, but she's so good at getting into the psyche that everything makes sense, even though the human part does not make sense. Does that make sense?
Totally. You know, when you were describing her attention to language, I was like, that's exactly the way she was in classroom. She was the most intense person, like her attention to every single word. You know, that's kind of like what she imparted, at least to me. But I love what you said too about contradiction, because that's what I'm always aspiring to in my own writing, you know, just because I think we're all very contradictory people. But no, I thought that was great what you said.
I want to take us back to poetry, because you just said you're primarily a fantasy writer. And I think it's interesting because we don't tend to associate fantasy writing with poetry or literary fiction, yet your stories are all of the above and more. And I thought it was interesting how in a recent interview you remarked how the fantasists you admired growing up, people like Tolkien, Robert E. Howard, used language to create a sense of mysticism and wrote poetry as world building. Can you speak to this also a little bit, you know, this idea of world building through that particular lens?
Well, I'm not going to act like I'm an expert on it, but so many of what we consider classical fantasy stories were originally poems. Beowulf, the Iliad, the Odyssey, these sorts of things. And I have always been drawn to that idea that poetry is another genre of fantasy. And it's a genre where you can engage with the narrative specifically without sort of getting bogged down in a lot of the details, which may come out, you know, if you were writing a straight prose narrative, now you have to describe the horses, now you have to describe the windows or whatever. But with a poem, you can focus very squarely on the story because the poem is a confined form, you know, especially older poetry, you know, it's written in meter and that sort of thing. So I was always drawn to not just poetry as a way of world building, which I love in older texts, you know, like Lord Dunsany does that as well. But Dunsany also wrote just straight poetry too. So I've been drawn to that, but I've also just been drawn to the idea of writing speculative poetry. Which is something I do more of today. And my last book was a poetry book that contained a few speculative poems. And because so much of world building is difficult to do, and you can't put a song in your book, right? You can't incorporate music. There's so many things that are hard. But poetry, like the written word, has always been that way where you can tell these expansive things about your world through the culture of that world. And I find that absolutely fascinating. Nowadays, you know, I read Sophia Samatar, who her whole thing is breaking form and writing a story as an encyclopedia entry or as a bestiary or as a, I don't know, a science book, these sorts of things, or epistolary. And I just find that fascinating.
Oh, and I actually didn't know about that, about poetry being at the root of so many fantasy novels, and that's a great realization. And in closing, I'm curious, because I know your next book is a novel, The Age of Ignorance, which should already win some awards, I think, for best title. I love that. And you've talked about how you've used poetry to recharge, and how you've even written chapters as poems, which I find so interesting. And I actually love, there's a whole YA genre of the novel in verse that hasn't really caught on in adult fiction, but I think it should. So I'm just curious how poetry is influencing your novel, which is a love story, as I understand it, but maybe it's fantasy as well, because maybe every love story is a fantasy.
I always go back to poetry to recharge. That's what I read. If I'm looking at narrative and, oh, how do I write this narrative? Then I might look at a novel I like and see what they did. I might go back and say, oh, well, how did this guy get a character out of this situation? Or how did they move from point A to point B? Oh, I remember something I read once. And I might go back to that. But the nuts and bolts of writing, I feel, comes down to language. And if I start feeling that I'm writing, you know, the same thing over and over again, and I'm not being creative, then I'm like, okay, how did somebody do this in a tight, confined space, right? Which, that's what a chapter is, and that's what a poem is. So I'm constantly reading poetry to recharge. I just taught a poetry class, and or a class that incorporated poetry, reading poetry to write fiction. And I very much did that because I was in that zone when I was in Paris working on Age of Ignorance. So there were a number of poets who I kept coming back to. You know, I kept coming back to Lillian Yvonne Bertram. I kept coming back to Dinesh Smith. I kept coming back to Eve L. Ewing. I kept coming back to Alexis Almeida. People who I'm just like, there's something, they keep breaking it. They keep finding ways of rearranging the alphabet, the English language. And I feel for me, poetry is essential because language is ultimately the most important thing to me.
I love that phrase, rearranging the alphabet. So thank you so much, Elwyn, for joining us, and congrats on your new book, which I'll remind listeners, it just came out April 16th, Weird Black Girls. So I totally recommend it.
Yeah. And the launch at City Lights was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Elwyn.
We'll be right back with today's book trend after this short break.
Well, Brooke, I know you're a dedicated daily listener, so I'm sure you heard this recent episode called AI's Original Sin, and it felt like we should cover this since there was some great investigative journalism, and it touched upon the book industry in really interesting ways. So here's the question. Where are we on the AI conversation these days?
Well, the outcome of this journalism the Times did was pretty damning, you know, but I guess also not surprising. They showed pretty much how these AI companies don't think the rules apply to them, or they just don't care. The biggest takeaway for me was that they need this vast amount of data, and they knew that in order to get it, they had to violate actual laws, copyright laws, and they did it anyway. And I guess there's some vindication here for the authors who were upset last year by this list that The Atlantic put out, where all these people discovered that their books had been used to train AI models. But I also think it makes me realize that, you know, like for us, the disclaimers that we're putting in our books right now that say, please don't use our content to train your AI models, are basically meaningless, you know, if the companies are violating copyright law knowingly, right? I mean, it's actually pretty crazy.
Yeah, one of the other points of intersection with the publishing world that was kind of amusing was that the reporting uncovered all these emails from company execs, and they were speculating about trying to buy Simon & Schuster, of all things, when it was for sale last year. And the idea was that they would then own Simon & Schuster's backlist, and they could train their models on that. But it was ultimately, you know, too expensive to go that route. So I had a fun time imagining the scenario in which Simon & Schuster is owned by OpenAI. I mean, it's totally crazy, right? To buy a publishing company, not for the books, not to publish books, but to harvest data and words, you know? Just totally nuts. You know, I thought about it, like authors have essentially become like cows to milk on an industrial farm. So I'm wondering, Brooke, do you think authors would have revolted?
Oh my gosh. I mean, it is funny to think about. Maybe so. And authors have a lot of cultural power. And I think they, many of them probably just would have left. I don't know that they would have been able to acquire new authors. I was thinking about how Roxane Gay left Simon & Schuster a few years back when Milo Yiannopoulos had that deal. He was the, you know, alt-right guy who was basically promoting child pornography. And Roxane was like, nope, I'm out. You know, and many people applauded her, myself included. You know, so authors have agency to affect change is the point I'm making. But it's also just an interesting, I mean, the speculative exercise is fun, but it's also a moot point, right? Because these AI companies just took the content instead without asking. And it does seem that this would give fuel to the lawsuits that are in the courts right now, notably with the Authors Guild and the New York Times. But if they lose those suits and the AI companies win, which is what I think is going to happen, then they're kind of effectively saying copyright law is not really what we thought it was, or it just doesn't even hold. And that's kind of upsetting to me.
Yeah, part of the story that stood out to me is that Google allowed OpenAI AI to scrape YouTube, even though what they were doing violated YouTube's terms of service because Google was doing the same thing. So Google effectively looked the other way, because to call them out would have been to draw attention to their own sins, to use the term from the story. And there's a bit of a question about whether anything is sacred anymore, like you say. I mean, laws and regulations exist to protect the vulnerable. In this case, we see these guys kind of playing God and justifying their violation of laws with the simple explanation that this is a big deal, that AI is changing the world and changing the culture. We've heard that before, right? That technology is going to save us or serve us. And I always think of what Kara Swisher often says. She says that Silicon Valley is the Wild West, and regulators always arrive after the harm has already been done.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I agree. And it's a real moment of reckoning. You know, I've been spending more and more time with AI, and it is very powerful. It is, you know, like, I have very mixed feelings about it. It's pretty cool. And it's also not something that's going to get put back into the bottle. So I imagine the courts are going to give AI companies some kind of exemption or rule that the content they're effectively stealing will be ruled fair usage for training purposes.
It's just such a strange moment. And I think what's happening with AI showcases something, you know, that's true in all of human history, which is that when faced with what we can do, humans will do it, you know. And that was true in the Industrial Revolution, and now it's true in the tech revolution. And how this will impact the writing and publishing world is, you know, obviously unfolding in real time. So we'll keep circling back as we know more. And we will know more, which is why we will be back next week with another episode of Right Minded. We want to be with you at every stage of your writing and publishing journey, whether it includes AI or not. And we want to keep including more people in this conversation. So please share this episode with others, with your friends and your robots. And we'll see you next week.